about the fact that I use an invasive species to keep my master gardener talks fresh. You know, and I think basically, you know, what it's all about is that, you know, when you're doing master gardener talks over and over, you just want to bring it to the people who are in the audience, and using the bug that's out in the headlines really helps. Now, this project that I'm talking about now was developed, as we call it, the Acorn Program. It's sort of a bit of a chance for me to sort of help me keep master gardeners fresh. And two of my good friends and colleagues over here, they also have some other interests in educating people. Bob O'Neill worked for a number of years in Honduras, working with campesino farmers down there, and he was involved in some sort of participatory research program where he was trying to teach basic IPM principles. And Rob was also at the Illinois Natural History Survey, was working with weed biological control, and was involved with the Purple Loosestrife program, and he was involved with teaching people about science through the biological control of purple loosestrife. And so we just, you know, we're sitting around getting together, just talking about the different kinds of programs that we're involved with, and we started thinking about homeowners and master gardeners, and these are the facts that sort of just screamed out at us. And basically, you know, we kind of realized, of course, this might have been spurred by a grant proposal, you know, an RFP, you know, that said that homeowners spend about $11 billion a year on pesticides. And the thing that struck us the most was that this means that they spend about 50% more on pesticides on an annual basis than they do on new plant material. Now, that really says something. That just sort of screams that maybe something ought to change. And, you know, I think in every article we wrote, Rob, we say per acre pesticide use in home gardens exceeds that of many major agricultural commodities. And I think I've seen some slides that Mike Rao put together earlier that sort of confirm the same sort of a thing. And applications and storage disposal are really challenged. So we just thought we'd try and combine our interests in biological control and general public adult education to see if we can come up with a way to get people to replace their pesticide use with some other alternatives. So our objectives were to reduce pesticide uses. We wanted to maybe give some guidelines to help people design gardens to minimize their pest problems. Use tactics that enhance and don't disrupt biological control. We were trying to embrace this concept of learning by doing, and this is a thing that Bob O'Neill, I believe, was kept on pounding into our heads, that, you know, that the way that people actually learn is by actually getting themselves involved in a new solution. And then we were hoping that by giving some of these home gardeners some basic concepts, they would be able to invent some of their solutions to their problems. And we were fortunate enough to get this thing funded by two USDA and CIPM grants, as well as some private money. So we developed this concept called ACORN. And you know, why ACORN? Well, actually, Bob O'Neill used to say that it was because we were nuts. But actually, it stands for the Alternative Control Outreach Research Network. And it's basically our idea that this was going to be a long-lived network, but as you well know, when the funding left, the interest, our ability to sustain it went down. But I think it's an interesting exercise that it was a network of master gardeners, extension educators, and researchers interested in reducing pesticide use in home gardens. We actually have a website that still is active that has all our basic training material on what biological control is and all about the slides that we use for our full-day training courses. And we had this full-day-long workshop where we introduced people about the concepts of biological control. We talked about experimentations. We gave people a chance to look at a lot of things. We developed some web-based backstopping that would allow the homeowners to, the master gardeners, to actually send their data to us via the web. Now, this was kind of interesting because when we were doing this, we actually got hacked by, I think, some sort of Chinese group at one point in time. And we were telling everybody, don't worry about being on the web, you know, it's fine. And we had these little hands-on exercises. And, well, all of a sudden, one day we got hammered with all these emails because somebody, every time they logged onto our website, it said something like, FUSA. So I can imagine after, like, you know, bribing these, like, you know, these semi-retired gardeners into, like, using this thing, you know, and just sort of blew their wigs off. It was really not the way we wanted to do it. But they got over it, and they actually And after a couple of bottles of Maaloxes, so did I. But in the process, we developed this. How we did. We would have natural enemy collections. You know, Bob had this wonderful collection. I think he had the student from Argentina at one point in time in the laboratory who was collecting all these Jorge Frana, who was collecting all these parasitoids on caterpillars, and he would collect all these gregarious endoparasitoids, and they kind of looked like little flags. You'd see the caterpillar, and then you'd see hundreds of parasites, you know, coming out of each caterpillar. And we had boxes of these things, and it would just really impress the living daylights out of the master gardeners that many parasites could come out of one little wasp. So we tried our best to really jazz up these people about biological control, and I think we did. We had live insects, and you know, we actually had people staying. You know, we had to kick them out the door, so that they really enjoyed it. We then, to my bias for liking to develop databases that people never use, developed this we call this an alternative control guide, which is basically an interactive web-based database that would allow people to search for pests based on the particular plant that they were working with. And we were focusing on vegetable gardens because it's a much smaller universe, where there would be photos of the insects and the crops. We characterize crops in terms of susceptibility to pests. We talked about different types of natural enemy profiles that could be used for different types of pests. We also suggested what kinds of resources you want to put into a garden in order to keep them there. So we were saying keep things diverse, you know, have things flowering as much as you possibly can. And we had some state-specific recommendations. And this is online, and it's probably a little bit out of a date, but it's a fun concept. This idea I borrowed from my neighbor Rick Foster, who's in the office right next to me. He put together this list of a very ingenious list of vegetable crops, which I really like, because what we use it to do is to illustrate to people that, you know, if you want to have a garden that doesn't use pesticides, then just plant things that don't get pests. I mean, it's pretty simple. So on the left-hand side, he made a list of all the plants that, you know, people could grow in their garden that just don't have a whole lot of pest pressures in the Midwest, and contrast that on the right, you know, broccoli, cabbage, you know, potato, squash, corn, that sort of thing. And, you know, that kind of simple concept was the kind of thing that we wanted to instill in people that they could actually do. So that's sort of a basic background of the kind of education that we gave some folks. But over a period of about 3 years, you know, Rob, Bob, and I trained about 225 people in small sessions in Indiana and in Illinois. And then what we did was I like databases, but I can't even touch the computer without messing it up. This was the first phase, and the second phase was with Justin Vitullo, who's in the back over there. We tried to continue this with roses. So I'm going to talk a little about some of the research that we did with master gardeners. And the first thing that we had to do was to try and get people to think about experimenting. And you know, I think initially our target was America's Master Gardener. I forget his name, but the fellow who's employed by Kmart. What? Jerry Baker. We wanted to sort of, you know, take him down with data, but that wasn't really going to work. But I thought this was one of the most creative things I've ever seen. This is called some kind of a motion-activated water scarecrow that's supposed to chase the rabbits away. So, you know, we'd show them pictures like this, and we'd get the group to talk together and trying to define a hypothesis, you know, what kind of hypothesis that you would want to test in order to see if this worked or not. You know, how would you measure it to see if it worked? We talked about the importance of replication and comparing to control. And I think that probably the biggest limitation that we have with home gardeners is that they got a really small area to garden, usually. And they don't really want to let that garden plot go for control. So I kind of like seeing things completely chewed up, because then I know that what works really did work. But they don't work that way. So I think that might be one of the basic limitations that we might have. But I think that, you know, that said, I think that they do like to actually work with things. So then we tried to, you know, tell them how to accept or reject a hypothesis, and then we wanted to discuss their findings using a listserv that we had for the ACORN research group. And we tested quite a few things. We did some work on augmentation biological control using trichogramma. Chrysopa larva. We did some work on conservation, habitat modification, and some of the stuff we actually were able to publish. I mean, Rob and I, we got this article on carabid communities in Indiana and in Illinois. We did some work with floating row covers, which we thought would be kind of interesting. We covered squash with floating row covers, and we found out that when it gets really hot in Indiana, people get belly aches from eating squash that is too hot. That's covered in a floating row cover because it's something that the cucurbitacin concentration gets very, very high, and people will actually eat the bitter squash rather than throwing away. That must be something about gardeners, which reminds me a story. Remember that time we were in Chicago, and we asked people. We always would start our presentations. You know, why do you garden? And this one guy, he just nailed it. He says. He sort of had this, I think he had some kind of like an Irish or Scottish type of accent, and he says, I garden for the pure misery of it. And we thought, now that's a guy after our own heart. So we really enjoyed that guy. So, I mean, I love working with master gardeners because they actually, they like to putter around in gardens and talk about plants, and that's kind of what I like to do, so it's just a lot of fun. So here's some data, which I'm compelled to present because this is a national meeting. And we found that, that when we got people to release Trichogramma with cabbage worms inside plots, so we actually were able to reduce the populations of cabbage caterpillars to actually economic levels. Now, that's the good news. The bad news that probably cost them $30 to control each plant, but at 19 cents a pound, they did like the idea, and they learned that insects can actually control some pest problems. We did some work on mulch versus no mulch in potato, but I for some reason we never took a picture of that, Rob. But we had pictures of it. I mean, I couldn't find one in my files because this actually predated the electronic versions of my files. And but we found that where there was no mulch, there were only 380 carabids in caught in pitfalls, whereas with mulch, there were like twice as many. Changing the habitat really does affect things, and this is the kind of information that we would use to try and demonstrate to our master gardeners that what they do can actually affect populations. We did some work with lacewings, and part of the fun was we could get these little lacewing containers, and if you ever want to show people lacewings, you put one of these things up on an overhead, and you can see them wiggling around, and everybody just goes wild with that. And so people like, Mike, you're talking about how everybody likes to work doing all the hands-on sort of thing. This is just a great way, especially if you're stuck doing workshops at night, just to show them live insects, wiggling them around. We did some work on weeding with snap beans. This is, I thought, we figured we wanted to try and increase the abundance of different kinds of organisms inside vegetable gardens. We thought, well, let's just see what happens if you don't weed for the first 6 weeks. Well, I'm even embarrassed to show what happened. Basically, the plants really got covered with the weeds and killed by the leafhoppers. So we decided that was a bad idea. So I'm not even going to show that one over there. But we did have people let the garden go weedy, and now we know why people weed their gardens. We did some work with sugar spray. Which was some of the work that Bob O'Neill had done with Luis Cañas for his actual dissertation work, where he was looking at what happens when you put sugar on corn in the tropics, and you actually can increase the natural enemy community and actually reduce populations of corn pests to a level that is actually acceptable in the tropics. On cabbage, what happens is that you have a lot of holy cabbage because it just doesn't really work. You get a lot more ants and a lot more parasites, but it just doesn't do the job. But it was a hypothesis that we tested, and the master gardeners can actually see that this stuff works. Okay, we did some stuff with Surround. Anybody ever worked with Surround? It's that kale and clay stuff that you mix around, and you turn your beautiful green garden into something that looks like it was painted with a dilute white paint. It works to some extent, but most gardeners just don't like it because it makes the garden look ugly, so enough said. This is the famous floating row covers that gave people belly aches, but I think that this has some potential for some other sorts of things, but this is a good example of mechanical type of control. So we played around in the garden, which was probably the main reason why I really got involved with it. In addition, we also were starting to change some of their behavior. Now, one of the things that we looked at was we wanted to see, you know, what kind of people were really in this sort of a project. And basically we broke down to people, this is, the yellow would be all the participants who we train, all 220 and some. These are the researchers would be the purple, and the blue would be, the non-researchers are the purple and the blue are the researchers. And basically we found that as a group, there wasn't much difference. Everybody would only, if, in terms of putting pesticides, they would just target their pesticides just on the infected plant only, which I thought was really great, which says to me that at least they're not spraying their entire garden every time there's a problem. So they're somewhat sophisticated in terms of IPM principles. But interestingly, when we did a survey, a pre-survey, we wanted to find out, you know, what group of these people, what was their tolerance to insect injury? And we found that people who said that they used biological control, I'm not sure they knew what that meant, or they said they had no pest management, I don't think they could care less how much injury was on their plants. They could tolerate 25% more distortion, discoloration, or any kind of feeding. But anybody who said they managed their pests, either by using pesticides or pesticides and biological control, they had a bit of a lower tolerance. So I think that these people generally are kind of uneducated in the pest control, and these folks are just more educated in that. And we found that people who used pest control, biocontrol at least once before, there was an increase in adoption after participation in the program. Whoops. And probably the most interesting result was we found that those that researchers, okay, before had one level of adoption, and after they had another level of adoption. So we found that people who were involved in the research program had a much larger increase in their adoption of biological control than those who were not actually participating in the research. So the take-home point of this is that research is critical to get these people involved in trying to adopt new technology. And there's a book by Rogers called The Diffusion of Technologies. I think it comes out of Iowa. I think it was in Iowa. And he says that, you know, in order to get people to change technology, to adopt new technology, you have to get them involved in things. Okay, now,